Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The United Farm Workers of America was founded in 1966 and led by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. The UFW famously organized boycotts, strikes, walkouts, and marches to protest low wages and inhumane work conditions for farm workers. Chavez and the UFW drew the attention of FBI Director Herbert Hoover in the wake of the Red Scare of communism in the U.S. Civil rights leaders and figures who took part in social justice movements became targets of government surveillance. Cesar Chavez led the union until his death in 1993 at age 66. He was succeeded by his son-in-law, Arturo Rodriguez. Rodriguez has been with the UFW for over 50 years, serving 25 years as the union president from 1993 to 2018. He's back in his hometown of San Antonio, and that's where he joins us to talk about the specter of suspicion that hovered over the movement in the 1960s and 70s. Rodriguez begins our conversation with reflections on how he first became involved in the farm worker movement.
It originally started here in San Antonio, Texas, and with our parish priest, Father Marvin Durfler, over at St. Margaret Mary's Church that we attended and participated in 1966, Father Durfler, along with a number of other priests and religious folks, went to the first strike that the United Farm Workers had, this where Cesar Chavez was at, in the Rio Grande Valley there in the melon fields. And so he went there, he came back, he got arrested, he marched, he participated. He just came back and he was just like all excited and was telling us how thrilled he was about being there in Cesar's presence, getting a chance to talk to him and listen to him and see what they were doing and the practice of nonviolence and volunteerism. And because everyone at that time within the organization and for many decades on, we were all full-time volunteers. Cesar lived in the same way that we all did. And was only making the $5 a week and the room and board. And there were some necessities that were taken care of, but it was basically that lifestyle. And so he was very impressed and came back and talked to us about it. That got me thinking about it. And then at St. Mary's University, when I went there a few years later, a number of my friends were already participating in the boycotts in the late 60s there with the table grape boycott and the lettuce boycotts and so forth. And so got involved in doing that and going to the produce terminal here at 4 a.m. in the morning. And there we were outside chanting and having our signs and the whole works. And then I went to University of Michigan to the School of Social Work. At that point, everybody that was there was Latinos, Hispanics that had come from all across the country, from Colorado, from New Mexico and California and Texas. And the one thing that kind of brought us all together was the farm worker movement. And we all had been engaged and involved in some particular way within the communities that we came from. And so that really kind of united us as students from all over. And so we spent our weekends in front of supermarket stores. Our Friday nights were in front of liquor stores, boycotting Gallo wine, walking up and down the streets. And then we ended up bringing Cesar Chavez to campus in our final year there in 1972. That was the first time I really ever had a chance to meet him and hear him and talk to him briefly and so forth. And again, I was just extremely impressed with how real he was and how straightforward he was, but simple-spoken, not a great orator, as you might know orators, but yet everything he said was so meaningful. And you could tell the sincerity was there and the deep belief that he had in terms of what he was doing and his willingness to do and make the sacrifices necessary to bring about change for farm workers, for their families, and in general about civil rights within our country. And so as a result, that kind of really got me thinking. And his brother, Richard Chavez, was at that time managing the boycott campaigns that we had taking place in 1973, there in Michigan. So Richard sat down with me and we talked several different occasions and finally he said, well, what are you going to do when you graduate? And I said, well, I'm not really sure yet. And he said, well, look, you don't have any bills, you're not married, and so why don't you come work for us for just 6 months? And that was always the hook, I found out later. That was the hook, just 6 months. And so, any rate, I went to Detroit and started working on the boycott campaigns, and I was hooked. I mean, I loved it. I enjoyed it. I felt like I was making a contribution. I was doing organizing work, which I went to school for. I went to community organizing sequence. I was working with people. And so as a result, I felt like I was doing something that was going to make a difference in people's lives. And that's how I got started.
Let's talk a little bit about that magnetism that Cesar Chavez had. You say that he was not really a master orator, so maybe not so much like Martin Luther King, but I don't think that there are too many people who you can identify as being central to a movement like Martin Luther King was with the Black Civil Rights Movement, and you have Cesar Chavez being associated with the farm worker movement, the labor union, the civil rights movement. He had something that drew the attention of many activists, but it also drew a lot of attention from Herbert Hoover and the federal government and the FBI and the CIA. So what was it, do you think, about Cesar Chavez that made the FBI so suspicious about him to where they would start opening files and surveilling him and the movement and the union?
Let me just go back a little bit, Norma, because most people don't know that Cesar Chavez really got his beginning back in the early 1950s. In 1952, working for an organization called the Industrial Areas Foundation, and they had organizations throughout the country. One happened to be that Cesar and Fred Ross Sr. put together and formed was called the Community Service Organization, the CSO. And that organization was all about bringing about change, especially in poor working class Latino communities. And even back then, Cesar Chavez, because of the work that they were doing, was called a communist because of the fact that they were considered rebel rousers because they were out there trying to organize Latinos into creating a dynamic voting bloc within our communities that we could bring about the changes necessary and so forth. And he also, at that point, began seriously working in farmworker communities. And so by the time that got started with the United Farmworkers in 1962, there was already this sense of the government and the powers that be had some sense of we need to watch and surveil in terms of what's going on. And the reality was is that when the United Farmworkers was started, there was no movements or no successful efforts to organize farm workers in this country that had taken place. There had been an attempt and a number of things that had been done, but nobody was able to sustain a movement over time. And so everybody kind of laughed at this point, but the momentum began to build. And by the 1960s, between 65 and 75, I mean, that was an extremely dynamic part of our history. There's been many, many things that have taken place and transpired since then. But at that point, we were on the front line stage, you might say, in the sense that the boycott was taking off with the California table grapes. And we were up against a powerful agribusiness industry. And as I mentioned, nobody had been successful at beating them. So they were trying to make every effort to suppress what was going to take place and what was taking place and to try to discredit everything that Cesar Chavez was doing, everything that the farm workers were doing, the farm worker movement was doing, anybody that was associated with the farm worker movement in that particular way. And so we learned much later when the Freedom of Information Act came out that, in fact, yes, the FBI had a 1,400-plus page file on Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers and the work that we were doing. And many of us were featured in that information. But I think that the powers that be were really forcing and pushing the FBI to find something to discredit us and try to discourage people from supporting the boycotts, because they really did take on a major effort. So much so that by 1975, Harris did a poll at that particular time. It was a height of the 60s and the 70s when we did our second great boycott. They estimated that 12% of the adult population in our country was supporting the boycotts of table grapes and gala wines, head lettuce at that particular time, which meant about 17.5 million people. So that is an extremely large number of folks. And what, again, is not really very commonly known is that it doesn't take a large percentage of people boycotting to really have an impact. So when you get that level of support, and it's international, it went way beyond the United States. It was in many other countries that people were also boycotting grapes and so forth. The growers and the agribusiness industry, they were trying to figure out, okay, what do we do to stop this? Nobody had been that successful. And we had already gotten contracts in the table grape industry in 1970 via largely because of the boycotts. And now we had both the strike and a boycott going on. But we knew the power was really in the boycott. So we would imagine that the agribusiness industry really convinced or pushed hard for the FBI, for other government agencies to really look and see and figure out and determine what can we do to stop this movement from taking hold. What can we do to discredit Cesar Chavez, the leadership of the United Farm Workers, the farm workers themselves, call them communist or call them this or that, whatever it might be, to disrupt the work that they're doing and hopefully take away the support, because we had large support from religious communities. We had by that time been able to develop probably one of the most diverse coalitions, certainly an extremely broad one within the civil rights movements. So we had the labor community, we had the religious community, we had students, we had activists, we had people from all walks of life.
Big political figures. You also had many Hollywood
celebrities. Yes, yes, definitely. And so as a result, we had done something that had not been done previously. And it was taking off and it was just gaining more and more power. So we had learned much later on after Cesar passed away that all of this had taken place. And we assumed it, because we knew that similar types of things were happening with Dr. Martin Luther King and with other major civil rights leaders within the United States and other parts of the world, Gandhi and so forth. So we assumed it, but at the same time, we knew that the work was important. We knew we weren't doing anything wrong. We knew we were not doing any of the things that they were accusing us of doing. And in fact, Cesar Chavez was a very devout Catholic. His family was. A lot of us that worked for the movement had strong religious backgrounds, not only from the Catholic Church, but from the Christian community, from the Jewish community, and so forth. And so we always were related to that. And at the start of every march, you always saw the banner of the Virgen de Guadalupe that was there. We did not do a march or even public events without having the image of the Virgen de Guadalupe there present to demonstrate, you know, where our loyalties were, what our culture was, what our beliefs were, what our values were, to really demonstrate and to offset anything that people might have been saying about us.
But again, even also Catholicism at the time, I mean, look at the candidacy and presidency of John F. Kennedy. You know, being a Catholic, people thought, oh my gosh, he is going to be under the purview of the Pope. So, you know, you even had sort of that going against the movement as well.
It was funny. I mean, I can remember at least, I know on one occasion that Cesar Chavez and his wife Helen, they both visited the Pope. In fact, it was during the time of the boycott, and I was relatively new. I was in the early 70s when I had just joined the organization. And you could see the support that that generated. And in fact, when I did my work on the boycott in those initial years, 1973, 74, 75, we had strong support from the Catholic Church as a result of it. And I remember I would spend lots of my time going to speak at masses, going to speak at Christian churches, going to speak in front of at Jewish synagogues and so forth to not only get support, but also get volunteers to help us stand in front of supermarket stores and to be able to talk to consumers about the importance of boycott and the impact that the agribusiness industry was having on them, especially in regards to we were learning more and more about the use of toxic chemicals and what that was doing. And I don't know if you remember Rachel Carson's book in the late 1960s. That's what got Cesar understanding what was happening when crop dusters were flying over farm workers and spraying the fields with these pesticides, but they were falling right on the farm workers themselves, falling on the homes that they lived in and having huge impacts. And oftentimes, especially back then, a lot of the children were still going to the fields with their parents because there was no place for them to go. We were unveiling all those kinds of things, and that was really getting and drawing the attention of consumers throughout America and was bringing about changes that the agribusiness industry had really never had to deal with previously.
Arturo Rodriguez is President Emeritus of the United Farm Workers. When we come back, Rodriguez says the FBI had a file over 1,000 pages long on Cesar Chavez.
Prior to his death, he did not want to see what those files even looked like or read them or have any knowledge about them. He didn't have a lot of confidence that we were going to get a lot of information from it anyway.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers were considered communist threats to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover in the 1960s. The FBI opened files and launched surveillance on the union leader and other individuals involved in the Latino civil rights movement. The FBI established its counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO in 1956 to undermine the communist threat to the U.S. The FBI expanded that program to include any person or group that the government considered subversive, like civil rights and social justice leaders and organizations. COINTELPRO's illegal tactics included anonymous threats, letters, phone calls, and violence. Arturo Rodriguez succeeded Cesar Chavez as president of the UFW after Chavez's death in 1993. He retired from that position in 2018 and serves as the union's president emeritus. Rodriguez says he was aware that something was happening insofar as government surveillance was concerned, but no one in the UFW could put a finger on it.
I didn't know of any particular thing that happened that I really saw or that I could attribute to the FBI or anything of that nature. But I do know that when we first moved from Delano, California, to what became the national headquarters for the United Farm Workers and the farm worker movement in Keene, California, that particular facility, we named it Nuestra Señora Reina de la Paz, the Queen of Peace. But at that particular time, Cesar had moved up there. But it was at that same time that we learned about that there was someone out to kill him and there was a contract on his life. And so he was going from city to city. We never had any hired protective service for Cesar. It was always volunteers that we trained. And then Cesar had German shepherds that he always went places with. And those were well-trained German shepherds, two of them, Boycott and Huelga. And so, yeah.
Great.
Oh, yeah, they had to be the part of the movement, too. They had to be. And they were very, very, very loyal. But we knew about that. And finally, Cesar made a decision after several weeks of just going from place to place and moving all the time and to be able to protect himself and others. He finally decided, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm going to go back to La Paz, where our headquarters is, and whatever the good Lord decides, so be it. But I'm going to go do my work because that's what we're here for. And that's the most important thing. We're not going to let them distract us or disrupt our ability to be able to organize farm workers, to be able to engage ourselves within the civil rights actions that we were doing with, whether it be voting campaigns or voter registration campaigns or getting people out to vote, whatever it was, or supporting other groups at that particular time in the early 70s as well. We became the first national groups to come out and support the gay community and get farm workers involved in that. Because at that point, it was not very popular at all during that particular period in history. all these types of things were happening, and we sensed that something was going on. When they had the contract out on his life, that was a scary and difficult time for all of us because we just didn't know.
And Jose Angel Gutierrez has written about the FBI surveillance on Cesar Chavez, and,
yes.
and he implied in one of his books that constant surveillance made Cesar paranoid and almost led to a disassociation from reality. And I'm wondering if you witnessed that at all.
I have not read the book that Jose Angel wrote, but I did not ever sense that. I've spent my whole adult life, 45 years, working full-time for the United Farm Workers, and 20 of those years was spent with Cesar when he was still alive from 1973 through 1993. And Cesar, till the day he died, he was always out there working extremely hard, doing whatever he thought was necessary. And he engaged himself in three very public fasts. The last fast that he did was back in 1988. And by that time, he was already in his early 60s. And that was for 36 days. And that had a huge impact on his life and so forth. But that didn't stop him. He kept on going. And in fact, I had a chance to talk to him the night that he did pass away. And I talked to him about 9 o'clock in the evening. I was in, at that time, Phoenix, Arizona, doing some public speaking there on behalf of the boycott there at the various university campuses and within the community. And we were preparing to go out on the road. And I was going to go pick him up so that we could catch a plane and go back east. And that night he told me, you know what, I'm tired, but let's go do what we need to do. And then the next morning is when I found out that he had passed away from the family and so forth.
Did you ever think that maybe there was anything suspicious about his death at the time, now that you kind of look back on it?
You know, when it happened, you know, I talked immediately to my wife, who was Cesar's daughter at the time, and talked to her brother, Paul. And immediately they asked me, you know, where are you at? And I said, well, I'm on my way to Yuma, Arizona, to pick up Cesar. And they asked me to go straight to the mortuary. The decision had been made to take his body back to California. And we were going to get a plane so we could be able to do that. And so as a result, I went straight back to the mortuary. We did not let them do anything to Cesar to check his body. We did everything there in California by people that we knew and trusted, and we felt confident. You know, if there was anything that happened, any malice that happened or that would cause his death, that they would be able to detect that. And we didn't find any of that. So it was just natural causes. And what did transpire as a result of, you know, everything that we went through, that Cesar went through, starting back in the 1952 when he first got started in public activism, was the stress. You know, and to suspect that you're being investigated by the federal government and not knowing who would be doing it and how they were doing it and everything else, but you knew it was happening, you know, it just created a lot of stress.
So we have Congressman Joaquin Castro, who is now asking the FBI to declassify a lot of these files of the Latino civil rights movement, including the farm worker movement. And I know that there are files already out there, the Freedom of Information Act. People can request some of those files. They're probably going to be very heavily redacted.
Yes.
But people don't get them back in a nice, pretty order. You're just going to get boxes of documents, and it's up to you sort of to figure out what's there. I'm curious to know if you've seen any of those documents and what you expect to maybe see if the FBI and CIA do end up declassifying a lot of these documents.
You know, we learned about, Cesar actually learned the fact that via the Freedom of Information Act that we could get access to those files, because by that time we had found out that the FBI was spying and there was surveillance taking place and so forth. But prior to his death, he did not want to see what those files even looked like or read them or have any knowledge about them. He didn't have a lot of confidence that we were going to get a lot of information from it anyway, because of the redactions that you were talking about and so forth. But after he passed away, I think it was around 1996, the LA Times, they actually got access to those files and went through and I guess put them in order and everything else. And we found out some things as a result of that. And we learned, you know, that the surveillance had taken place, that there was people at our rallies that were stationed there on the part of the FBI. In fact, it was insinuated that there was actually someone on our staff, or maybe more than one person on our staff, that were actually somehow tied to the FBI or providing information to them about what we were doing and that type of thing. But the final conclusion was by the LA Times was that they didn't find any evidence of anything that was being alleged, that we were not communist, that we were just working hard, had strong beliefs and strong values about civil rights in our country and the ability for farm workers and working families, that they should have access to everything else that anyone else has in the society, and that their rights should be respected. They should be treated with dignity, just like anyone else, because they're very skilled workers in terms of what they were doing. No matter what industry you worked in, whether it be the vegetable industry or the fruit industry or wine grapes or dairies or whatever, that it took a lot of skill to do that kind of work.
So you succeeded Cesar Chavez as president after his death. And I'm assuming at that point, maybe some of that FBI surveillance had let up. Did you sort of have a different experience than Cesar in your position as president, because it didn't come with that high-profile spotlight that he had had for so many years?
The efforts of the United Farm Workers have not slowed down in the sense that, you know, we've been in existence now for over 60 years. And the biggest pressure we felt was that Cesar always kind of, not that he knew when he was going to die or anything of that nature, but he would say that if this movement died when I died, then all the work that we've done up to this point in time would be for naught. We would be abandoning the people that we believe in and that believe in us and have faith in us and have confidence in us and have hope that we can change our lives and we can improve conditions and we can improve situations and so forth, and that their children, most importantly, can have a future. And so as a result, that's the kind of pressures that we felt, that we cannot let this movement die. This movement has to continue. We got to keep organizing. We got to go out there and challenge the system and challenge the agribusiness industry and challenge the powers that be to continue ensuring that farm workers have the faith and confidence and working families in general. What people would always say, especially within the labor movement, that if farm workers can do it, then anybody can make things happen. Because that the conditions had been suppressed for so long and their efforts and so forth. And we still don't have a national right to be able to collectively bargain and collectively organize, but we keep fighting and we continue winning and getting changes made. And it's slow and it's hard and it's arduous, and but we just got to keep doing it and keep moving forward. So we always knew that we were still challenging the same systems that Cesar was doing, and that Dolores Huerta and Richard Chavez and Helen and all of them were working against during the times when they first started the movement. But we knew at the same time that we could not let that stop us. And we could not be intimidated. We could not be coerced. We could not discontinue doing the work that this movement had been doing since the early 1960s.
And it's still going on, like you said. I mean, there are still legislative battles, and I'm thinking particularly in California, about protections for farm workers, about wages, about collective bargaining. So, like you were saying, it doesn't really make headlines as much anymore, but the fight is still there. And I know the UFW has a very strong online presence. I follow them on Twitter. So there's always these great videos of this is what the farm workers are experiencing. This is this person. She's picking strawberries out in this heat. And it's because of her that you're able to enjoy, you know, your strawberry shortcake in the summer. So the effort is still there.
Well, Cesar had this strong belief that you just don't go out and deal with the worker issues at their work sites. That you have to go beyond that. They're there 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day. Even if they're there 12 hours a day, they still go back home. And they've still got all these issues that they face. And they have their families and all the concerns there. So there's housing issues, there's educational issues, there's trying to deal with all the issues of infrastructure within their communities and so forth. It wasn't just the United Farm Workers. And we've built organizations, some during the time that CESAR was there, but many of them have been built since then. The National Chavez Center and the CESAR Chavez Foundation was one of the organizations that had started under the what we called back then National Farm Worker Service Center. But it evolved into an organization now that deals with affordable housing and deals with education issues and deals with communications. One of the big dreams for farm workers always was back in the 1960s when we first started was we just want a radio program. We just want a half hour, 15 minutes on a radio station to be able to talk about issues that are important to us so that we can communicate with the farm worker community. And literally, we would go and we would buy spots and we would buy time on a radio station, Spanish-speaking radio stations, to be able to get access to workers. And so they had this dream of having a farm worker radio station. And finally, in 1983, we were able to do that and set up the Radio Campesina. And then we dealt with all the social service issues, immigration and other issues that workers, that their families face and everything else. And then we're very much engaged in politics, both in terms of our support for candidates, for those organizations that can be able to do that, and then all of the civic engagement work about getting folks registered to vote and getting out to vote and signing people up and getting volunteers and involving ourselves in that particular way, especially with candidates that have supported farm workers and supported working families. Those are the candidates that we're out and we're engaged in constantly and looking for ways to provide them with the help and assistance that they need. So you have this movement that is just evolving and growing more and more and more. And so now we're engaged in Washington, Oregon, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and we've started up on the East Coast in Georgia and New York. We just won in the last 3 years, 4 years ago, collective bargaining rights for farm workers in that particular state, and Michigan. So the movement is growing, it's expanding, it's continuing to do the work that we started to do, but even do it beyond what the initial dreams were and the hopes were and desires were.
So you're officially retired, right? But do you still keep getting pulled back in?
You know, I still work part-time for the United Farm Workers.
Okay.
And for Teresa Romero, who's our current president. And I work very closely with Paul Chavez, who actually just retired from being the president and CEO of the Cesar Chavez Foundation, but he still chairs the board of the Cesar Chavez Foundation. And so we've had a relationship going back all the way to the early 1970s. And then with the United Farm Workers Foundation, we're very heavily engaged, I should say, in immigration reform. And that's something that I'm very close to because of the fact that we've spent the last, 24 years since 2000 trying to get that to happen. And we've gone through all different kinds of fights and struggles and efforts to really make that happen. But I know it's going to happen. At some point, it's going to happen. So, yeah, I keep very much involved in all of that. So I sit on a number of our different boards and continue to go to Washington, D.C. when I'm needed to do various things. I'm part of the National Equity Commission that the United States Department of Agriculture with Secretary Tom Vilsack. He asked me to co-chair that here 2 years ago. And so I've been a part of that, the work that we're doing there. We have an event coming up in the Rio Grande Valley. But yeah, Norma, I enjoy it. My wife and I, Sonia, and myself are very much involved at our local church that we're a part of, St. Margaret Mary's, and a community organization that's based here, and that's COPS Metro that Ernie Cortez founded. So that's kind of given us life here in the city, doing things that we enjoy and that we hope we can make a difference in people's lives.
Arturo Rodriguez is President Emeritus of the United Farm Workers. He was talking to us about his time in the UFW under Cesar Chavez and about government surveillance on the labor rights leader. San Antonio Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro wrote a letter to the current directors of the FBI and CIA asking to declassify and release documents pertaining to the surveillance of the Latino civil rights movement. Castro joins us next week to talk more about his effort. He'll be joined by his mother, activist Rosie Castro, who herself has an FBI file she's never seen. Thanks for joining us today for Fronteras. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marianne Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.